Hello and welcome to the Tackle HIV Talking Stigma podcast. I'm Gareth Thomas, and throughout this series, I will be talking to some well-known guests about stigma and resilience. What it is, what is it like to experience it, how to overcome it, and what needs to be done to make stigma a thing of the past. Now for today's episode.
I'm Helen McDowell from Vive Healthcare. Joining Gareth and I today is professional rugby league player, men's coach and campaigner, Keegan Hurst. Hi, Keegan. Thanks for joining us today.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I'm really looking forward to this.
Starting his career in the academy at Bradford Bulls, Keegan went on to play over 400 times for a number of professional rugby league clubs before he retired in 2020. Since then, he has transitioned from a very successful sports career into a prominent advocate for inclusion. His journey from playing rugby league to becoming the first British professional rugby league player to come out publicly as gay has positioned him as a symbol of courage and resilience. Keegan's openness about his sexuality in an interview with a national newspaper marked a really important moment in sport. And since retiring, he has used his platform to build awareness and drive change, and to focus on his new vocation of inspiring others through his personal story and promoting inclusivity in all aspects. Fun fact, Keegan has also appeared in TV series First Dates and the Celebrity Haunted Hotel. Now, Gareth, we'll talk shortly about your shared experiences and perspectives with Keegan. But just reflecting on where we are, 2025, more than 40 years since that first case of HIV was reported. And living with HIV now is so very different to how it was then. We've learned so much about the virus since that first case. The science has really evolved, but sadly, attitudes have not kept up with those advances. HIV is still misunderstood, and most of that is driven by a stigma which still exists. Whilst HIV is a manageable condition and has been for many years, many people living with HIV still experience stigma in one form or another, being excluded or shunned by family and friends, to being discriminated against at work or elsewhere, even in healthcare settings, or being verbally abused. The fear of stigma really sadly prevents people from getting tested and seeking the healthcare which could support them and enable them to have a much better outcome and a healthy, productive life. This increases HIV's grip on people who are most at risk. With that, we see people living with HIV reporting higher rates of anxiety and depression than those who don't, and stigma, again, plays a factor into this. Now, Gareth, before we get into the big conversation of today, can you just reflect a little bit on why this campaign is so important and why conversations like this matter?
Yeah, I think, as you said, times are very different now, yet stigma still exists from a time when things weren't different. So things haven't changed as far as stigma goes. You know, I'm a product of my environment, a product of my upbringing, and there was a version of self-stigma with me when I first found out about my medical diagnosis because I'd never been taught anything different. I'd never heard anything different. I'd never seen anything different apart from the adverts that were created in the 80s to scare and shock everybody. And as far as science and medicine has come, in the fact that I live with HIV now, I take one tablet a day, I live a normal, happy, healthy life, I'm not restricted physically or mentally by it. The stigma that's in society means that I assess certain environments before I go in them. I can, you know, be in an environment and feel the stigma in that room. I feel almost like I don't deserve to be there. So for me, it's really important that we educate to allow people who are living with, and not just people who are living with HIV, but people who are affected by HIV, in the fact that families of people who are living with HIV, friends who are living with HIV, employees of people who are living with HIV, know, have the correct information which makes them powerful enough to make them right decisions. Because, you know, HIV, as we said before, HIV is very different now. Just we need to educate people on what the difference is, so then we eradicate stigma.
Thanks, Gareth. And that is the purpose of the Tackle HIV campaign, supported and working with the Terence Higgins Trust as our charity partner, and with support of many big names such as Prince Harry and Elton John from around the world, as well as many sports and celebrities as well. Now, Keegan, you're super passionate about the journey of self-acceptance, and a fantastic TED Talk that sort of outlined your journey and the importance of that. The importance of being true to oneself. And I know that's a piece that Gareth really shares with you from his own experience. And so you two both have many parallels in your journeys, but also have, of course, very individual experiences and feelings that you have been through on this journey. You've both elite sportsmen in rugby league and union, and also had both lived through that expectation of what it was to be an elite rugby player, to be an alpha male, to be strong, to be tough, and to be married to women. Now, you've also both lived through that journey of coming out as gay, and of course, what has followed from that. So just to get us kicked off, maybe if you could share with us a bit more about that journey for you and from your lens.
Thank you for having me on. Appreciate being here and being able to talk to you guys about you know, stigma and everything and yeah, sharing my story. I'll give you Keegan 101 in a nutshell. So I grew up in, as you can probably tell by my accent, I grew up in the north of England, West Yorkshire. Grew up through the 90s, and it was very much small town vibes. You know, you do as you're told, you get a job, you grow up, you have kids, you get married, you go on holiday once a year. If you're lucky, and you'd be grateful for your lot. And that was kind of the attitude that, you know, I was brought up with. And there certainly, there certainly wasn't any, I wasn't aware of any gay people in the town or on TV or anything like that. I think the only people I was aware of were people like Elton John, George Michael, Freddie Mercury. And I know what I look like, I know what I sound like. And so I kind of grew up with that kind of attitude. And, you know, my mum brought us up on her own, and she was very much of that mindset as well. Rugby league is very popular where I grew up. Rugby union's for the posh lot where I grew up. there was no chance of me getting involved with that. But I didn't start playing rugby until I was older, about 11. And I was honestly, I was crap at it. Like, all you have to do in rugby league is catch a ball and run. And I couldn't do either. I loved the camaraderie of it. I loved the being around the lads and feeling part of something bigger than myself. I think like I'm just generally a team player. Puberty was very good to me, and then I ended up in academies and things like that. Now, I suppose when I look back, I probably knew that I was different, certainly gay, maybe. When I was about 13, I certainly wouldn't have admitted that or said that, but I don't know whether it was denial or hope that I'd grow out of it, and that it wasn't, you know, it just wasn't the dumb thing to be gay, you know, where I grew up and at that time. And so I just kind of pushed it down. And as you said, going into, I would say, as I kind of came into the first team at rugby, I would say that I was at the back end of what I would call the old school. You know, the people who go to the pub all the time, you know, tell your wife to shut up, like, lads, if you got to do this, you got to do. It was very much, you know, men are men and this is what we do. And, you know, and I was definitely at the tail end of that. And so that, I kind of contorted myself to fit in with that, when, you know, that is definitely not who I was. And obviously tied in with that is societal expectations and things. And I met my ex-wife when I was 19. We were seeing each other for about 3 months, and then she was pregnant, which was definitely not planned. now I grew up, my dad wasn't around when I grew up, and I'm sure that played some part psychologically, that I wanted to be a good dad, and I wanted to be, because after all, you know, I'd convinced myself that this is what life is, you know, life is getting married and having kids. And so I just similar to rugby, just trundled down that path and did what I thought was expected of me by society, by my mum, by my friends, by everybody. I did that. My daughter was born. I was 20 years old, which, you know, thinking back and talking about that now is so ridiculously young to have a kid. As I was kind of working my way up through my rugby career. And I think probably a couple of years after my daughter was born, I was like, these feelings aren't going away. What do I do about it? Now, I think when people talk about being professional athletes, they talk about, you know, you need to have talent, professionalism and grit and determination. You also need to be really, really stubborn and just be able to stick things out. And that was something that I had in spades. So I just doubled down. We ended up in very quick succession. We ended up getting married. We had another kid. We bought a house. We got a couple of dogs. And suddenly my head and my hands were very full with a young family, a career, sorting a house out. And I just didn't have the opportunity. I guess I didn't give myself the opportunity for any kind of introspection to think, you know, is this who I want to be? Is this what I'm about? Is it, you know, is this the path that I like? There was none of that kind of, there wasn't time for that. You know, nappies needed changing, money needed earning, stuff needed doing. And that was kind of the way of life for a few years. And then again, probably once my son got to, probably about 2 years old, things had kind of settled down. And then it was like everything that I pushed down over the years just kind of hit me all in a one-er. My mental health went through the floor. I was like, I felt trapped, I think is probably the best way. I'd put myself in this situation, not just myself as well, like, you know, my family. I got myself into this situation that I thought was going to make me happy, that I thought would make everybody else happy. And actually, there was a real dissonance between who I was and who I was pretending to be. They were miles apart. And to bridge that gap, I just trained more. I was out of the house more. After games, I'd go on to the pub. I'd go out for, you know, days at a time. Drugs were involved. Like anything I could do as any kind of escapism. And obviously that had a massive impact on my relationship with my wife, with my kids, with my teammates, with myself. And it kind of got to the point where it was untenable. And we both agreed that we didn't want our kids growing up thinking this was what a relationship was. And so we separated. And with that separation, which I, you know, like I said, I've been with my wife since I was 19. At this point, I was probably 26. Late in the year when I was 26, and I had this opportunity to actually look at what has been going on, because I didn't like who I was, I didn't like how I acted, I didn't like how I behaved. And then I guess I not realized, because I probably, like I say, realized a lot many years before, but came to terms with, accepted the fact that I was gay, which was a bit of a revelation, because it was like, oh, not a revelation. It was a relief, I guess, because I was like, this is why you've been acting up. This, you know, this makes sense. You're not just an asshole. And I think that was quite a relief for me. But then with that was, well, what do you do with it? You know, what do I do? Who can I tell? Can I tell anybody? Is it going to have an effect on my career? How's it going to affect things? And I think I'd love to say that I had this moment of epiphany and I thought that, you know, I could make a difference and I could make a stand and I could be really brave. But it was none of that. It was that I was kind of at rock bottom and I just thought, what's the worst that can happen? And I went and I told my wife, who understandably didn't take it very well. I told my mum, she didn't take it very well. So then I was like, this is not going, even though it wasn't going well, I still felt like it was the right thing to do. I guess for the first time in life, I was being honest with myself and with other people. And then I shared it with my teammates. who were fantastic. They were great. They were absolutely fantastic. My coach was brilliant. And I was worried about telling my coach. He was at the time a 60-odd year old.
Was it John Keir?
John Keir, yeah. He was in his 60s. He was from Barnsley. He was very old school. And I was captain at the time. I was worried. And I remember speaking to him on the phone. And he said, in a very thick Barnsley accent, he said, it doesn't matter to me that you're gay old cock. It just matters that you're a rugby player and you're my captain. And from that point, I thought, do you know what? I think I'm going to be okay. The chairman was good. The fans were good. I told everybody privately, and then it became, and then the papers were going to run a story, and I went and spoke to, I think it was The Mirror, and we did a big interview, and then it kind of took off after that. That was 10 years ago. It was 10 years ago this year. It was 2015 when I came out. And, you know, obviously going through a divorce and having young kids, my kids were 7 and 3 at the time. It was very tricky and difficult to navigate, and it was by no means easy. But as time has gone on and I've got more comfortable with my sexuality and who, because I think people think, oh, you come out, you're absolutely great with being gay. And I wasn't. I was starting to get my head around it. I remember when I first came out saying the word gay, I'm gay, it would literally stick in my throat. It was, and I guess, you know, that ties in with what you guys are talking about, that self-stigma that, you know, I didn't like the fact that I was gay, and it was admitting it, accepting it, and that's a whole process in and of itself.
Yeah, I think it's amazing when you do the coming out process, as they call it, is one day or one evening you go to bed and you have this very personal information that's just yours and your loved one's information. And the next day you share it with the world. But everybody then who looks outside in feels that you've completely changed in just the saying, you know, of two words, I'm gay. They have this massive misconception then that all of a sudden you've gone from denying who you are because you're afraid of societal impact to all of a sudden embracing who you are and being okay with societal impact still being negative against you. I think it's a really interesting thing around kind of what society expects when you announce something of your own acceptance of yourself and how quickly it can happen. And did you feel did you have at that moment in time, or say for the first 6 months maybe after, moments where you felt like, why have I done this?
I don't think I've ever regretted it. I don't think I've ever felt, why have I done this? I did definitely feel like I don't know what I'm doing and I'm in over my head, particularly with it being so public, because I think I came out privately, for want of a better phrase, you know, to people in and around my life in maybe the May, and then it was in the front pages in August. So I kind of had, you know, 2-3 months to get my own head around it. And I think what I found difficult was people telling me that I was a role model, people telling me that I was a hero, like all these insane words. You know, I was just like, I'm just a kid from the asshole of West Yorkshire. I'm getting my own head around it. And it's like people asking me for this really deep and meaningful insight on, you know, my own introspection and being gay and being an out athlete and yada, yada, yada. And I was like, I honestly, I'm just trying to go from one day to the next. And it took me a while to be able to work through my own stuff and then get to that point. So yeah, I definitely never regretted it, because the relief that I felt from just being honest with other people, even though I wasn't fully okay with it myself, the relief of not having to hide that anymore was incalculable.
How did you find then going from, and it was a question again constantly asked to me, and I'm just really interested how you dealt with it, how you dealt with going from Keegan Hurst, the rugby league player, who when he did interviews just spoke about the next game or the previous game or his training, to all of a sudden being this hero and this figurehead who is asked really deep and meaningful questions and expected to give kind of life-changing information to the rest of the people who are get, who are living in the position you used to be living in.
Yeah, it was definitely daunting. You know, I mean, you speak to most rugby players and they can't string a sentence together, right? And then we're being asked to be Confucius.
Yeah.
I think what I did and what I've always tried to do, and maybe I was naive early doors because I had absolute, right? Like, we don't get media training or anything, do we? It's not like, you know, we know what to say. So I guess I was very vulnerable. I was very open and honest. And I would just say what I felt. And I didn't try to dress it up. I didn't try to, you know, speak like a politician and say words, but not actually say anything. I would be quite upfront. And I think people just found it quite endearing, you know, rather than trying to, I certainly didn't pretend to have all the ideas, and I would say that all the time in interviews. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just making it up as I go along. Yeah. And I think people found that quite refreshing.
So how did you feel? Because I had one, and I feel like, I don't know if you had one, but you've definitely had moments where all of a sudden then you have kind of, say, this like coming out process or coming out party, where all of a sudden, and I know you have, you know, I know you're really good friends with Anthony Cotton and he's really good, helped you, but all of a sudden then you're kind of introduced to these really high profile people, and the only thing you have in common with them is something that you've never wanted to define who you are, and that's being gay. So, you know, you meet all these huge celebrities and everybody's congratulating you and applauding you on just being authentic, really, on just being gay. So how do you deal all of a sudden then being rocketed into that? Because again, what society then, I feel, don't understand is that I'm sure just like yourself, especially having heard your story, I didn't come out. As you've said, you know, you came out for yourself, for your own reasons. Yeah. I didn't come out to be a hero. I didn't come out, you know, to be treated differently. I came out to want to be treated the same as everybody else. So when you do all, how do you deal with all of that and the expectancy then that people look at you and think, well, he only did that because he wanted to be famous. He wanted to be in the newspaper.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, yeah, because you always get that thing of Joe Bloggs who says, I don't care about his sexuality whilst commenting about your sexuality.
Yeah, of course.
If I'm being totally honest, I, as a rugby league player, I wasn't even playing in the top division then. I wasn't even playing Super League. So I...
Where was your barrow? Was it which is division one?
Batley,
that's it. Yeah, Batley.
Me and Fox's Biscuits are from Batley. so at the time, the only reason I spoke to the newspaper was because John Keir, who does a lot of media stuff, he said, I think they're going to run a story on it and you might want to get in front of it. And obviously having a young family and going through a divorce and it being difficult with my ex-wife at the time, I was like, I do not need this. And that was the only reason that I spoke to the newspaper. It was to just save myself some aggro. And when that went into the paper, I had... Yeah, like you said, I had messages from Emma Watson, Tom Daley. I had a phone call from Elton John. And then I was going for dinner with Anthony Cotton and Ian McKellen, and I was invited to these awards. And it was really surreal. And I guess I'm really lucky that I had Anthony and I became good friends with him, because he kind of steered me through it. And the rugby lads definitely kept my feet on the floor. Again, I was just very, I'm just a lad from West Yorkshire. I grew up on a council estate and I've never been ashamed of that. And I've always talked about that. And I would do in the company of these people, like I would be, people might call it like false humility or whatever, but I never pretended to be anything that I wasn't. And I just kind of went along with it. And, you know, there's been some surreal stuff. I wouldn't, songs. I had Ian McKellen singing in the front of my car, and you know, like really ran like random stuff. And you just go, how the have I got here? But it was just kind of par for the course, and I guess I just took it a day at a time. I look back now and I think I don't know how I managed, you know, getting through it all, but it was very surreal.
There's some huge parallels because obviously both of you are so authentic and just, you know, laid out bare bones kind of where you're at. And I think that is very endearing and people can relate to it. And that's what's really important, how you have such a powerful platform, which is why that's probably propelled you to these sort of these places, those settings with other celebrities who are sort of welcoming that. Keegan, I'm intrigued. Obviously, you were going through this internal battle of understanding whilst Gareth was, you know, also, and then went public 2009, I think it was, Gareth, wasn't it, when you came out. How did what Gareth did play into your thinking? Did it affect your thinking and sort of how you saw yourself, given, you know, a lot of your concerns or feelings were like rugby players just aren't gay? Or should I say male rugby players? Because obviously the feeling in female rugby is almost the opposite way round.
Yeah, do you know what? I think rugby union and Gareth coming out fell. Now, this is probably a story that I told myself to justify not doing anything. That is totally different. That is a totally different set of circumstances. Mm. You know when you do that thing where you go, it's easy for them.
Yeah.
It's easy for them. Gareth's captain of Wales. He's playing in Six Nations. He's doing this. He's doing that. Like, and rugby union, like I said, for me as a lad who grew up in the north, rugby union is just, well, it is a completely different sport. But it was so far removed as well. And I think we tell ourselves stories of why we can't do things often. Also, we tell ourselves stories why we can do things. But I was very much in the woe is me, I can't do anything, I am powerless, very victim, life is crap and it's all happening to me. And I just felt like I was keeping my head above water. And I think when you find yourself in that position, you don't have the, you kind of blinkered and you just go, I am just dealing with what is happening right in front of me right now. And if you did have the ability to kind of just take a step back and go, actually, you know, all the things that I'm telling myself are not true. There is someone who's done it before. There are, you know, because I was like, oh, I'm going to lose my job. I'm going to get fired, which was, you know, it's actually illegal. So if I'd have had the, you know, circumspection to be able to just take a step back and take a look at what reality was, it would have probably been easier. But I think because I didn't speak to anybody about my sexuality, nobody knew. I kept it all bottled up. And that is when someone says to me, what is your biggest piece of advice that you give? And it's speak to someone, even if it's a stranger, because you can't read the label when you're in the bottle. And I was very much in literally and figuratively in the bottle, and I could not see the wood for the trees. So even though afterwards, you know, and even talking now, me and Gareth can draw so many parallels, I just couldn't see that at the time. So okay. I was very much in my own little bubble.
Yeah, I think everybody's story, regardless of where you come from, what job you've got, everybody's story, they create it to be uniquely their own.
Yeah,
regardless absolutely. Of other stories. So why do you think it is then? As I know somebody who's got a lot of answers, because a lot of things you do know kind of give answers or give a sense of authenticity and reality. Why do you think it is then I, yourself, and millions of other people live their lives constantly trying to please members of society? And in our case, members of society that we'll never even meet, like people we will never even meet. We choose to be unhappy to please them.
How long have you got? I think it boils down to human beings are communal, societal creatures, and we want to be a part of something. That I am so against this mentality of the lone wolf. I think it's an absolute crock. Right. Like, nobody succeeds purely on their own. Nobody has a fulfilled, happy life on their own. It's, you know, that's why we have a male loneliness epidemic, is because people over the last however many years, people have, particularly men, have been told, you know, you can do that, and you can't be vulnerable and open and honest and authentic. And that's why we have, you know, all the crap that we've got around masculinity and men and loneliness and things. And I just think we are all so desperate to be accepted, even, and that's why so many of us live these kind of false identities, put on these facades, these masks, because we would rather live with the discomfort of that than the discomfort of being alone, being ostracized, being othered. And, you know, again, to tie in with the stigma, the thought of someone standing and like a group of people standing and pointing a finger at us and saying, you're different, you're weird, you're odd, you're not like us, is a horrendous feeling. For whatever reason you are othered, whether it be sexuality, race, religion, preference of TV program, it's not a nice feeling. And I just think we are hardwired to make sure that that doesn't happen.
So I just want to clarify something with you, because you said something earlier that I think is relevant to this point and really struck a chord with me. And I think for the listeners to understand that it's not the way out. It's when you spoke about rugby and you spoke about what rugby gave you, it gave you an identity. So when I look at playing rugby for me, I look at finding rugby and loving rugby so much, because in a world where I didn't know my own identity, when I put that jersey on, I felt like I was part of something. And my fear is people gravitate towards something that'll give them identity, but they'll still be unhappy. Is to understand that trying to find something to give you your identity, you already have your identity, is trying to find your honest identity rather than trying to find something that you feel will give you an identity to hide who you really are.
Yeah, I think that it's so prevalent. People often do it with their jobs, don't they? They throw themselves into their careers, whether it be sports, whether it be work. Some people also throw themselves into their identity as a father, a brother, a friend, a partner, and they cling on to that. And I think what I've come to understand is that these things are all important to us, and they are a part, they can be a part of our identity. They should amplify our identity. Like I am Keegan. I used to introduce myself always as, I'm Keegan Hurst, I'm a rugby player. And it took me so long to not do that. I would just introduce, I'm Keegan Hurst. Mm-hmm. And if someone says, what do you do? You know, now I'm a coach, or I used to play rugby, or they are parts of me, things I've done, and they exemplify certain values and traits and characteristics of me. But they are not who I am. But it's so easy, you're absolutely right, Gareth, it's so easy to hide behind, you know, a rugby player, a doctor, a husband, a whatever. And it is a dangerous thing, because when that gets pulled out from under you, which, if you're an athlete, that we all have a shelf life, when that is done and that's taken away, I mean, you know, there's so many examples of that, of people who've retired and struggled. Tony Adams set up Sporting Chance because he struggled with his own addictions, because he tried to fill that gap that was left by his identity being taken away. So it's the world over. But yeah, it's dangerous to try and find your identity in something that's external.
Yeah,
because they should add to who we are.
Obviously, over a long period of time, you've both gone through journeys of self-acceptance, and it'd be great to hear from you sort of what advice would you give to your younger self now, if you look back, or to young people who might be also going on that journey themselves. What is there anything retrospectively you can look back as to sort of what helped you sort of through that journey the most? What were the key moments? Who were the key people? How can they sort of like help accept that realization process?
Yeah, so I think number one would be speak to somebody else, whether that is a friend, a family member, or even a complete stranger. Sometimes it's easy to speak to a stranger, right? Pick the phone up, talk to the Samaritans off the top of my head. You know, there's lots of people. I know you guys mentioned Terrace Higgins. They've, you know, they've got a helpline. There's lots of people you can talk to. I think, I know it's like an old adage, but a problem shared is a problem halved. I think, and again, this kind of ties into what I was just talking about, the masculinity stuff, counter to that, vulnerability is a superpower. Yeah. Being able to say, I feel this way and I am struggling with whatever, is it's so relieving of pressure to that I, you know, you feel that you have to behave a certain way. So finding someone that you feel that you can do that with, and that is really important, because you don't just want to unload on Facebook or to a random down the pub. It's about finding someone that you can really be vulnerable with, and by vulnerable, this is how I feel, this is what I'm thinking, this is where I'm at, and just being able to get that off your chest is, it, for me, that has been the thing that has taken me from someone who was very scared, very angry, very reactive, very fearful, to someone who is very comfortable in their own skin, to someone who is, you know, I would consider myself, you know, strong and open and honest and have integrity. And I don't think that has always been true of me, but I would hand on heart say that I feel that about myself now. And it's because I've been able to do that. It's because I've involved other people, whether it's been friends, whether it's been coaches, therapists, you know, that I've had lots of people help me out. And I'm very proud to be able to say that I have asked for help, because that is not something that, you know, a decade ago, that version of Keegan would have done.
And also, I think is really important on this topic is that we don't just speak about the individual, the person with maybe the identity crisis or the problem, is to speak to the people and the people who listen to this podcast who are potentially the people around them. So when you're saying find someone, I think it's really important to try and be that someone. I think so to maybe be proactive in starting conversations and don't just throw off comments like, yeah, you know, like I always used to do when you walk into a rugby change rooms or you walk past somebody and say, oh, you okay, bud? It's be like, are you really okay? You know,
and
I have time to listen to that person. If they want to stop to have the conversation, you know, be a you and be a listen for that conversation. So as much as I think it's an important message to the individual, if you're somebody who is a potential friend to somebody else who has the problem, be empathetic towards that as well. Create an environment where somebody can, you know, be open enough to speak to you. As Keegan said, vulnerability is a superpower because we all try to hide it, but try and create an environment where somebody can use their superpower and not be judged in front of you by them. So I think it's a really important message to the people who are listening as well, that you not be that individual, but you be that group as well.
Yeah, so there's the support, but also the allies, the people who will sort of understand, call out some of the sort of stigmatizing language that people use around identity. I mean, how have you ever experienced that? Have you held people to account in a conversation when they've used language that you're just like, no, that's not cool. You can't use that language.
I feel with my education, or with the education of the subject, with my life experience, I've come across things and I've learned from different experiences and different environments what should and shouldn't be said. You know, I was very much like Keegan in the fact that, you know, I was thrown into this world. I didn't know, you know, I didn't know what to say. I didn't know when to say it. But I learned. And then when people were saying what I felt was discriminatory, derogatory things, then I would voice my opinion and say it. But I'm interested to know, I know with Keegan, because I feel, for instance, within certain environments, especially where there's a sense of masculinity around, and then it almost feels like when you talk about something that's societally, you know, maybe seen as something that's,
you know, not alpha male. So you walk into a changing rooms all of a sudden, as an openly gay person, all of a sudden, like when you did it, did that environment change in any way? Because I know with me, there was kind of a, I remember there was a really defining moment. Now, as you know, rugby players, before any training session, usually gather in the physio room. Everybody's hanging around the physio room. And it was just at a time when Ricky Martin had just come out. And I was having physio on the bed. And one of the guys came in and didn't see, because I was face down on the bed having a massage, and came in and said, "Oh my gosh, have you heard, guys? Ricky Martin's gay. I can't believe it." And you could just cut the atmosphere with a knife, because they didn't know, that person who said it didn't know that I was in the room. And I put my head up and you could cut the tension. And I was like, "Thank God we're finally talking about it, boys. You know, it's okay to say the word gay around me. You know, I'm not going to be offended if you come in here and tell me a fact that Ricky Martin's gay. It doesn't mean like you can't say it." So was there a moment within the changing rooms with you that you kind of felt that, right, okay, it was awkward, and all of a sudden we can talk about it, just like we can talk about everybody else's life. Everybody, all of a sudden the changing room becomes normal again.
Yeah, so we had, I kind of told a couple of the lads, it kind of filtered out and everybody knew. Mm. And I had a few people come up to me, and some people shook my hands, some people hugged me, some people didn't say anything. Like you said, there was that little bit of, oh, is this a bit awkward?
Yeah.
And I think maybe one or two training sessions after, kind of everybody knew, we were out on the field, and I think the kickers had been messing about. You know how they split backs and forwards, and the backs go kick the ball, and then the forwards have to do all the output. So we'd done a bit of that, and then one of the coaches said, "Bring all the balls in, lads," and someone just off the hand went, "You'll like that, won't you, kids?" And it just, we all laughed, and it was like, thank God we're all being normal about it.
Yeah.
I think as soon as you can kind of, and that's what, it's so important to be able to laugh at yourself, isn't it? To be able to have a look at things with humor and look at things with good intent, because there's a difference. There's ignorance and there's willful ignorance.
Yeah.
You know, like I was very aware that some of the lads, I was the only gay person that they knew. So when people were saying, there was a couple of times people would say, "Oh, don't do that, it's gay," and I would go, "Don't say that," and they'd be like, "Oh, yeah, I didn't mean it like that." And it wasn't that they were homophobic; it's just that their use of language was really lazy.
Yeah,
and it's not until you pick someone up on it, and then there's obviously a different kind of ignorance where you correct someone or educate someone, and they choose to ignore that. That's very different. But I think, you know, being able to go into those kind of environments with think and give people the benefit of the doubt, and that they have good intent, and that it's just a lack of education, you know, most people are receptive to things.
Yeah, because I do think it's important, because we, as much as we advocate talking about it, sometimes people don't talk about it because they don't know how to talk about it, or don't know the language they can use. And I feel like you've just said in the example there, with my example, it was a case of, like, I'd rather you talk about it and be wrong and let me correct you than we don't talk about it at all. So I think, again, that it's not just about us talking to society here, it's about us also talking to the individual to understand, if somebody has never come across a gay rugby player, if somebody has never come across somebody who's living with HIV, I'd rather you get things wrong and allow that individual to correct you than never talk about it again.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Because of cancel culture, we live in a world where what you say is more important than the intent behind it. And that, for me, that's the wrong way around. You know, I totally agree with everything you've just said. It's better. I used to, there's a lad we used to play with called Jody, black lad. And we used to sit and have like really deep conversations about sexuality and race. Mm. And we kind of gave each other the grace to be able to say the wrong thing. Mm. But, and then we would correct each other, you know, in a nice, because we knew that the intent was, we were both wanting to understand and learn more.
It comes from a good place, what you're trying
100%,
to say. 100%.
And I think it's so important to you said it earlier, Gareth, create those environments where that is the default. When we say something, it's from a good place, and you're not going to be reprimanded for saying the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Because that kind of frees people up.
Now, the million-dollar question, do you still think, you know, given both of your experience, we're in 2025, is there still stigma about coming out as gay in rugby? Union, league...
Right, I'll answer this because I'm interested. I'm really interested, in fact, to hear Keegan's. But I'll go out there first, and I'll say, I feel like there has to be, even though I feel society has changed, there's something still deep rooted within sport, because I feel it would be wrong of us to say that we're in an equal and a diverse environment within sport when in 2025. Having the platform that sports people have, professional sports people have, we are still struggling, male especially, to name, you know, 5, maybe 10 openly gay male participants of any sport globally. Now, that says to me that there has to be a problem. Whether that's a problem at grassroots, whether that's a problem when you get to professionalism, I feel they're kind of... There kind of has to be. But I am more interested, I think, to see one, if, you know, I don't expect for the agreement's sake to agree with me, but what your opinion is, because I think you do a lot more with the LGBTQ community probably day to day with what you're doing now than I do.
Yeah, I agree. The fact that we're not inundated, and I think this is twofold, and you touched on it there, Gareth, the professional element and the grassroots element. So I think the grassroots side of things, the professional side of things, people like our age, I think those people who might have been gay, I think they're probably happy to just go through the career and not come out. I think the juice isn't worth the squeeze. They don't want the aggro. I do think that we will get to a point where people are just coming through the academy system and they are gay. And then there's not this big, I'm telling everybody I'm gay now. They've just been gay, they are gay, they've always been gay. I do think we will get to that point. I do think the numbers are skewed because of grassroots level. And if you think about this, football, rugby, kids are cruel, right? We all know kids are cruel. You're a gay kid, and, you know, let's say that you're a stereotypically more flamboyant, maybe a little bit more effeminate, but you want to go play football, you like rugby, you tip up and you train. Is that environment welcoming? You know, we spoke about that environment, didn't we? Is that environment welcoming for these kids to stay there and stick it out? And I don't think it is. And whether that's obviously the coach's responsibility, it's also parents teaching the kids to be more active. You know, there's lots of elements to it. So those kids who come into grassroots, they go, I love football, I love rugby, but I don't feel welcome here. So I'm going to go, and they go to, I don't know, gymnastics, dancing, you know,
something more stereotypically acceptable.
Yeah, because they are accepted and welcomed regardless of their sexuality. And I think it's like a two-pronged, reason why we're not seeing more out gay male athletes.
So definitely more to do there, and I sincerely hope society does get to that place. But I think it's a difficult time. Look globally at sort of inclusion is a challenging space, which is why your voices, whether it's about sexuality, whether it's about living with an unexpected medical diagnosis that's had an impact on your life and coming over, the stigmas that are associated with that, because I know that applies to both of you. Your platforms and your voices are so, so important. We are sadly running out of time, so I am going to ask you one last question around, to leave our listeners with something. Like, what can they take from this? What do you think in terms of self-acceptance of individual differences about being yourself? What would be the advice you would give to people on that journey?
Firstly, I just think, based on this podcast, I think this has been a brilliant podcast. I think it's been super interesting. And for me, I think the takeaway from me, because I feel, in a way, I've maybe fallen off it a bit, I think is to listen more. I think we've spoken about creating an environment where either you as the individual feel like you can talk, or whether you as the individual feel like you can listen. I think that this podcast has been such a such a deep-rooted one, I think, in personal stories and lived experiences that I feel like there's obviously a massive synergy between me and Keegan, but I really feel that our lives, whether we wanted to change them or not, could have been so much different had we had somebody that we felt that would have listened to us. And I think, say, being that, having that ability to talk firstly takes an environment or an individual who is willing to listen. So information is key around the HIV education, which again is filled with stigma. We've got the tacklehiv.org website. Go to Terence Higgins Trust website or follow us on @tacklehiv on social medias to educate yourself and to educate others about HIV as well.
Thanks, Gareth. Keegan, your sort of like takeaway thoughts, anything, people, resources you direct anyone to support them?
Number one, I would say self-acceptance is worth the work, because it is work and it's worth it. So even if you find it difficult, keep going. Number two is we all have a responsibility to help, to work through our own self-acceptance and get to where we want to be, but to create that environment that Gareth's talked about, how you behave online, what you comment, how you speak to people, checking in on people, noticing if someone is okay, if they've gone quiet, and listening and being that person. I think we all have a responsibility, without sounding cliche, you know, be the change you wish to see in the world. Mm. And then, you know, as for resources, I'm just going to do a very big shout out to therapy and to professional counselors. And I think, because again, there's a stigma around that, asking for help is weak. If you have a bad elbow, you go see a physiotherapist. If you have something going on in your head, go see a professional. Mm. Because we want to work through things. It doesn't make you less of a man. It doesn't make you less of an anybody to go and ask for help. So just don't feel that you've got to stick it out on your own. Charities, I mentioned the Samaritans and Terence Higgins and Albert Kennedy. There's so many charities out there, but also, you know, professionals as well, and in the NHS if you need that.
Awesome. Thank you, both of you. This has been a really brilliant conversation, and thank you so much, Keegan, for joining us today. I think it's really clear that the key for this is compassion, communication, listening, knowledge. And they are really important tools to help everyone through their individual journeys. So thanks for joining Keegan for this episode of the Talking Stigma podcast. For more information, please go to tacklehiv.org or the Terence Higgins Trust website. You can also follow us on social media @tacklehiv, and please do look out for future episodes where we'll be talking to some other well-known guests about stigma. Thanks. Bye.